You may have noticed that there's two, I guess you could call them almost like two streams that define one's spiritual life, I guess you could say. Certainly as it relates to one's waking to a reality. And it's the fact that there's these two streams that it's very confusing for people. There's the stream of insight. Insight is simply, aha. You know? Aha. Oh, I understand. Aha. Insight being different than understanding necessarily. Simple understanding. You know, it's not just sort of a mental conclusion. It has a mental component. All insights have a mental component. Aha, I understand. There'll be an intellectual component. But there's also an experiential component. The very sense, the very word we give for insight, like aha, is the aha is a very sort of physical component, right? It's your entire being participating in an insight. So insight is sort of, you could think of it as that's the sexy part of spirituality, right? Insight gets all the attention. It's what's impressive. It makes for good storytelling. Do you know what I realized on, do you know what day, you know what year, what minute, do you know? And insight is a part of spirituality that gets most of the attention in a certain sense. And it's for good reason, because if we don't have any fundamental deep insight, then we're pretty much often stuck in a state of confusion. But there's a whole other part of spirituality that kind of, it's the not sexy side. It's sort of subterranean. Insight can be instantaneous. You can even awaken, have an instantaneous moment of realization. But the other part is the sort of subterranean part. It's the really experiential aspect. Now, you can't really divide these two. You can't divide insight from experience, because if you have insight with no experience, then you've not had actually any insight at all. You know, you've just had a conclusion that you've went, okay, I'll believe that. So they're very linked, insight and experience. Often in spirituality, we'll say, like, I had the direct experience of realizing what I am. So it's a combination of experience and insight. And the strange thing, however, is that these two sort of streams, although they're totally interconnected, they also have their own independence. And what I mean by that is, some of you have probably had the experience of, you have a particular insight, a particular understanding, a fundamental shift in the way you see something. And at the moment that the insight's there, everything seems perfectly clear. So clear that you could never, ever, ever possibly even think about maybe forgetting about it. You know? It's one of the tricky things about reality. One of the qualities of when you bump into it, in whatever way you bump into it, it has the sense of being totally complete, because reality is always, it is totally complete. But so it always has a sense of being totally complete, whether your insight is totally complete or not, do you know? It has a sense of being complete and absolutely obvious, do you know? Almost like, how did I not see that before? It's so obvious, you know? It's like you see something that was standing in front of you the whole time and somehow you didn't see it. So all of a sudden something seems very obvious in insight, you know? And when it seems obvious, you can't imagine that it will ever not be obvious. Yeah. But then the days go by, or the weeks go by, or sometimes the minutes go by. You know, and you still have some this you still have the sort of fundamental insight. You still have a certain quality of it, You still have a certain knowing of it. But then all of a sudden, experientially, it's like part of you. Have you ever had the experience of knowing that a particular identity or a particular way of thinking or thought itself, that you just see through it and you see through its illusion, you realize it's not really true. This pattern of thinking, this identification, this isn't real, it's not true. And it seems totally clear at the time. And at some later time, you'll still know it's not true, but all of a sudden you'll find yourself doing it or buying into it, right? Or being taken away by it. And you'll have this sort of contradictory experience. I know this isn't true. Why am I believing it? So how can I believe something and not believe it in the same moment? Did anybody have this kind of experience?
I thought so.
How is it possible that I can know and not know at the same time? How is it that I can have be clear and deluded simultaneously, right? If we've never had any, you know, really true clarity, then we just sort of assume that if when we're clear, we're clear, and when we're deluded, we're deluded. But then you get a little experience and you realize it's not quite that simple. You can be clear and deluded about this at the same time. Not only can you be clear and deluded at the same time, you can be clear and deluded about the same thing. So you can be experiencing something that your insight tells you isn't real, but you can still be experiencing it nonetheless. Sometimes an insight, a moment of aha, great or small, will sort of dispel the whole illusion, whatever that illusion was, in the mind and in the body, in the level of insight and the level of experience. So I think just through using this particular example, there could be lots of different ways this could unfold. But it seems like a lot of you know have had the experience of having some insight about something and then finding yourself being simultaneously clear and confused about it. You know? Or I know that's not true. Why did I just say it? Mm-hmm. I know that thought isn't true. Why do I keep thinking it? And why do I keep getting upset about something that I know isn't really real? You know? Now, I'm assuming that you've seen it wasn't real through insight, not because you read it in a book, you see. Of course, if you just read something in a book, then you haven't had any fundamental insight. Then, of course, you'll experience it and it won't line up with what you've understood. But it's one of the confusing things that I think a lot of people run into in spirituality. You can even have the insight that there. We often call this insight a waking up because it's sort of a very fundamental insight, cut to the bone, they might say. You might have an insight, a realization, or an awakening that there isn't really a authentically separated self. That it actually isn't there. You can have an insight that it's not actually there. There isn't a separate self there. You can have the insight, and in a very authentic way, sometimes a very powerful way, and then at some other point in time, that separate self that isn't there will suddenly appear, even though it's not really there. You see, it can't be there. But it appears anyway, right? So that self that's not there appears anyway, and it starts to cause you all sorts of havoc, right? But you know it's not real. You know it's not true, maybe, if you've had that sort of fundamental insight, that fundamental awakening. So on the level of insight, you may know it's not real. But on the level of actual experience, You may still be experiencing it. That's really confusing to people. And it's confusing these two streams. It's the unconscious assumption that they're always the same that creates a lot of confusion. There's a vast difference than the realization that there is no separate self and the total disappearance of a separate self. So the separate self is nirvanized, which means cessation, to cease. You can realize that it's not really there or it's not really real in a really authentic way. In fact, in a very liberating way, in a way that feels extraordinarily freeing. And in a way that you know is true. And then the very thing that you know isn't true and isn't real, it can seem to appear again. Has anybody had this happen to you? That's the difficult part of spirituality, is it doesn't lend itself to a sort of linear logic patterns of the mind. It just doesn't work that way. Your experience, which it's not just spirituality that doesn't work that way. Life doesn't work that way. Do you know what I mean? It's not just a hidden component of life called spirituality that doesn't obey the laws of linear thinking. It's like basically nothing obeys the laws of linear thinking. If you look at it closely enough, you know, the more closely you look at something, the less it starts to obey all these sort of linear laws. So that's why sometimes it sounds kind of like nonsense, do you know? That you can have a sense that you know isn't there and you know isn't real and it can still appear anyway. And then you can really be left scratching your head. Well, I had this a wonderful awakening, you may say. Saturday the 13th in 1974, 12:30 in the evening. And I knew that I wasn't I. I knew that I wasn't the person I thought I was. And I knew the person I thought I was never existed except as a bundle of thoughts and all that kind of stuff. You've heard it all before, probably. And you have that, and at that moment, it's as clear as day, isn't it? As clear as day. The most obvious thing, you wonder how you never saw it before. Absolutely clear. It may stay that way. If you're like the other 98%, at some moment in time, that thing that doesn't exist will sure seem to come back. You know, then you have a strange, almost like a split experience. I know it's not real, but it's here. Right? I know it's not true, but why do I keep thinking it? I know that thought isn't true, but why does it keep running me, even though I've seen it's not true? There was a time that I thought it was true. Of course, it would run your life if you think a certain pattern of thinking is true. Of course, it would take you away. But if you've seen it's not true and then it comes back, then you know it's not true, but it's still shanghaiing you. You know, it's still imprisoning you. That's a strange dichotomy. That's a strange paradox. And that is not an unusual paradox. That's extraordinarily common. And so we have this stream of spirituality that's all about insight. Like I said, it's the sexy part of spirituality, you know. It's what you like to talk to your friends about, you know. I had this amazing insight, you know. Right, an awakening in, you know, 2003, and it was this, and it was, you know, it's all insight stuff. You might talk about how it felt and everything, but this other stream is sort of the, like I said, it's subterranean. It's not disconnected from insight, but it's also not the same. It's the experiential falling away of self. Experience has shown me, And certainly when I, you know, that you can have a insight into no separate self and still have a lot of separate self there as an experience. The energy of it. Because one of the things I think that's another thing I find sometimes people are confused about is a lot of spiritual teachings make it appear as though that the separate self is just sort of a cognitive intellectual illusion. And all you have to do is sort of wake up from the cognitive, this, you know, it's just a pattern of thinking. It's just a way of thinking about yourself and referencing yourself and talking to yourself and all your ideas and opinions and beliefs. And it is all of that. But it's more than that. It also has a very energetic quality. It has an obvious emotional quality. And even deeper than an emotional quality, it has an energetic quality. The energetic quality of the separate self is what I call personal will. It's that energy, what I want, what I don't want. It's that thing that... It's the strange thing about that energy is one can only understand it in its absence. You can only understand it when it's no longer there. When it's no longer there, then you can go, oh, now I see that there was a certain kind of energy that got me up every morning, motivated me in almost everything I did. It motivated, it pushed, it drove my life forward, right? Whatever that was, to success, to I wanted to be enlightened, to I want more friends, to I want to find my soulmate, to, do you know what I mean? I want to be understood, I want to be loved, I want to be a saint, I want to be a sinner, whatever it was, do you know? It's the basic energetic driving force of life. That makes sense. At least sort of egoic life. And it's very much an energy. And like I said, it's hard to understand while it's still there. You understand it to the extent that it's not there. And this other subterranean kind of part is the often gradual, while insight can be instantaneous and sudden, this other stream, it can be totally sudden, but it's often more gradual. The gradual eroding of separation on a non-conceptual energetic level. And I would bet just about, in fact, I think I would bet anything, that there's a lot of people in this room that have had and are having their own experience of this falling away, of this basic energy, this personal energy, this personal will. Because you no longer then feel driven. You're not really driven to succeed or fail, for that matter. You're not driven towards, well, think of all the things human beings could be driven towards, you know? All the drive, at a certain point, it just goes, what? It's just not there. There's no there there. You know, you just, as my aunt, God bless her soul, she's no longer with us, at least in body, she used to say, I just can't get it up for that anymore. That was her way of talking about losing her personal will. I just can't get it up for that anymore. Now, of course, if we're going to stay and soar in the realm of ego, if we're in that realm, to lose personal will, you really can't. You can only have personal will sort of like wounded. But that's not a good thing.
You know, if you're going to stay in the realm of separation and ego, you want a certain amount of personal will, because it gives zest and meaning and direction and purpose to your life. Do you know? And egos need that. Otherwise, they start to catastrophically tailspin. Do you know? Like, oh my God, there's no meaning, there's no purpose. Why am I here? I'm not good enough anyway. Do you know? It's not really that's not really what I'm talking about. That's not a really authentic falling away of the personal will. That's often either wounding of it or suppression of it or denial of it or, you know, something. So if you're going to stay in ego land, well, you don't have to worry about not having personal will because you'll have it. It may be wounded, but you'll have it anyway. The expressions of that kind of energy are all the ways that we look for meaning and purpose. Those kind of activities, those are expressions of that energy. They're sort of some of the outward forms of it, do you know? We want to, and you see it as as you grow up, you know, you hit your late teens and your 20s, and all of a sudden you're in the phase of your life where you're supposed to become somebody, do you know? I mean, maybe in your teens you're supposed to be looking for yourself, do you know? But in your 20s you're supposed to definitely be starting to become somebody, making something of yourself, for God's sake, you know? We paid all that money for college, now make something of yourself. Go out there and be somebody, accomplish something, do you know what I mean? Make money, be successful, whatever. 2.5 kids, dog, you know, cat, I don't know, whatever you like. Do you know? That part of oneself that's always trying to... Through purpose and meaning, it's actually looking to prove its own worthiness of its existence, do you know? It's all about trying to feel good about yourself, is it not? And that's that energy. That's the personal will. That whole energy. I'm not saying it's good or bad or right or wrong. I'm just trying to describe a particular type of energy. And it also infuses into spirituality. So you get into spirituality, and that energy goes, I will become enlightened. I will break through the gates of illusion. Do you know, I will battle Maya until Maya is completely defeated, and I will be, you know. I'm overstating the case, but for some people, I'm not overstating the case in any way whatsoever, you know. But. And when that's the case, that's fine too, because you can't really, you know, you can't help it. It's not good or bad in the same way that, you know, childhood isn't good or bad, or infancy isn't good or bad, you know? It's just something you grow out of if everything goes well, you know? But as you know, you can be what we call age-wise an adult, but still be very adolescent. In fact, I think a lot of adults have a really hard time getting out of adolescence, you know? You can meet 80-year-old adolescents. You know, emotionally and, you know, psychologically and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, you can meet 13-year-old sages. So, in many ways, an authentic spirituality runs almost, in a certain sense, against the grain. It runs at cross purposes with certainly most of what we're taught, you know. So if you're, say, 22 years old and you have some deep and true profound awakening, let's say, to your true nature. And at some point, more than likely, that personal energy, that personal will, we could just call it personal energy too, starts to disappear. Maybe all of a sudden, and maybe it just starts to leak out the bottom, you know. And there you are. I see people like this all the time. There you are. You're 22 years old. You're supposed to be making something of yourself, not only in your career, but in your relationships and all. It's the whole building phase of your life from 20 to 45 or so, if you're lucky. And then here you have this great insight, and the whole energy system that pushes it forward falls apart. It happens. In fact, it's happening more and more and more and more and more and more, as far as I can see. I meet people in their 20s all the time that come to see me not because they're pursuing awakening, it's because it happened and they don't know what the hell to do. Do you know? They're halfway through Berkeley and their parents have already forked out a couple hundred grand on their education. And something just sort of practically wise says, it'd probably be a good idea if I followed through on this and just got the degree. You know, it'll probably come in useful. But the sort of the egoic driving energy now is drained out of their system. And they don't know what the hell to do. Because something tells them, if I just sort of sit on a curb and do nothing, that might not work out particularly well, you know? Maybe in India, but not here, you know? And yet the drive starts to disappear. So people of any age, you'll feel that. You'll feel that. It's sort of, I'm kind of joking, but I think this is actually true. It's sort of like premature aging. You know? I've always found that, you know, just the aging process itself, if it goes well, you know, if it kind of just grows the natural way, as you get older and as you age, you know, some of this personal will crap, even if you have no awakening or anything, it starts to fall away if everything goes well. You know, most people panic in their middle life when they notice they've topped out, you know. They had their kids, they've made this, you know, the most they can hope to happen in their job is to be demoted. You know, because they're probably not going to, you know, put a 60-year-old guy is not going to be promoted anymore. It's going to be the 30-year-old guy or whatever. You know, you've reached, and sort of if you're lucky, kind of something in you just kind of goes, oh, that's okay, actually. I don't feel so driven for that anymore. I don't really need to be at the top of the heap. Gosh, I don't really feel like I have to prove myself anymore. It's one of the nice things about aging, do you know? If it goes well. In this country, often it doesn't go well because we do everything to condition you to make sure that you're miserable the older you get. So that you don't get to reap the benefits of some very natural types of unfolding. Where you can, there is a richness that, an extraordinary richness that is part of life that has nothing to do with the accomplishments of one's will, of one's personal energy. It's not like there's no life after that. It's not as if there's no richness. There's nothing to do except, you know, sit in a cave and contemplate your toenails. It's not like that. There is an extraordinary richness to life, which in comparison makes the old sort of driven life seem very, very pale, do you know? Because the old driven life, you feel like you're being driven, do you know? Like I said, in different ways. Maybe you're driven towards some spiritual goal. Maybe you want money. Maybe you want to be loved of or approved, or in this country, our God is celebrity. You know, maybe I'll make it onto a horrendous reality TV program and everybody will know my name. Or, you know, we have some really weird, you know. But there's not much reflection in our culture of the benefits of all that just sort of falling away. forget about even awakening for a moment, just a life that kind of goes its natural course. It just sort of, it kind of climbs up the mountain, whether it gets very high or not. Who knows, you know? Some people climb a high mountain. Some people climb a pimple. You know, but in the end, it actually doesn't matter, you know, because everybody lands back down onto the same earth they started from, you know? And, you know, when you've met that, have you ever met that sort of, they don't have to be of, let's just say, of age, but someone of age, maybe, I mean, you know, in their 70s, 80s, 90s, something, and they've just, they've done it, they've been through it, they've, but it hasn't defeated them, right? It hasn't drained the life out of them, it hasn't made them go dead, but they've just, they're no longer driven by all that stuff. They're totally at peace in their own skin. They're totally secure. They don't give a damn what you think about them. Do you know what I mean? But they love you. You ever met someone like that? They're lovely, aren't they not? They're absolutely lovely. You talk to them for 2 seconds and you're like, oh man, this is great. I could talk to you forever. Or not talk to you forever, do you know? Of course, that can happen at any age. There is a naturalness to the way things can move. I've always seen spirituality as simply accelerating something that is naturally going to occur anyway. But there are some sort of strange adjustments along the way. So nowadays, there's a tremendous number of people, a lot of people, that have had their own sort of certain type of awakening, let's say. It could have been some cataclysmically big thing. It could have been I'll be darned. And it doesn't really much matter, do you know, how the package it comes in. And this, what they didn't count on, what they didn't expect necessarily, was for this personal energy to, like, when you have that awakening, it's as if something comes and puts a hole in what that tank of personal energy, and now it's draining and starts to disappear, you know? And it's odd when it starts to disappear. No longer are you then pushed. You're not compelled. You're not driven to prove yourself. You're not driven to complete yourself, usually through someone else or some activity or some kind of success. All that sort of personal energy starts to ebb away, sometimes very suddenly, sometimes gradually, often a kind of a combination of both. It leaves many people in a sort of strange limbo. Well, what do I do? If your whole life has been driven by what you wanted, by the personal energy, and all of a sudden it's not there, what's directing you? That's the question a lot of people come to me with, you know? What's directing me? What do I do? I'm not driven anymore. But they haven't discovered the other, we could call it a different kind of energy that comes from wholeness. Usually most people are going to experience this extended plateau of where the personal energy has greatly or almost entirely disappeared. And then there'll be sort of this limbo phase where nothing else comes and informs you. That makes sense to some of you? Right? Everyone would like, I'm fine with that disappearing as long as something better shows up. You know? Every movement of my being is the will of God, something like that, you know? And there's great clarity and great certainty with it, and, you know, all that. And sometimes that happens because, you know, it actually is quite simple, but, you know, it's the simple things that can kind of confuse us more than the complex sometimes. So most people will go through this sort of phase, this limbo zone, where that energy is diminishing and diminishing and diminishing. And what's diminishing with it is self on an energetic level. And often also whatever remnants of self there are on the intellectual and emotional level as well. It's a bit like if you were roaring down the railroad tracks in a huge diesel locomotive going 90 miles an hour with your foot pushing the pedal firmly on the floor. And then suddenly you had some insight and all of a sudden you weren't, there was nobody there to put its pep, to push your foot on the floor. There was no motivation to do it. You knew you weren't actually going anywhere, you know? And so you wake up from the whole thing, but you still have this 90 mile an hour careening locomotive, right? It does not like it just jumps off the tracks, you know, because you become disidentified with it. It often has this sort of karmic momentum, right? So even though you're not fueling it, even though you may not be identified with it, it still has this way and that it's, and this, and its energy is slowly disappearing. Now, some people have the transition for them is, you know, it's a hop, skip, and a jump. They barely know it's even happening. And some people, this sort of transition is big, very confusing, disorienting, what the hell happened to my life kind of stuff. And everything in between. So everyone will have their own totally unique experience of it. So far, this isn't a good sales pitch for enlightenment, is it? Just occurred to me, this isn't. That's the great thing, actually. If it ended up being everything we wanted, it would be just a total unmitigated disaster. I was talking to someone yesterday and they asked me, because we talked a little bit about this, and they said, it sounds like you're making a distinction between ego and self. And I said, I am. I don't see them to be the same thing at all. They're often lumped in the same bag together, you know, like a bunch of produce, and then you just imagine it's all the same produce, you know, because it's in the same, but it's not. And the person was saying, well, what's self then, you know? Well, the most simple way that I can, and I'm talking from an experiential level. I'm not talking philosophically. I'm not talking psychologically. I asked a great friend of mine who's been doing psychology for like 45 years. He's a great psychologist. I asked him one day, I said, what's the definition of ego in psychology? And he goes, which one do you want? And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, I can think of 10 right off the top of my head. I went, okay. That confirmed everything I ever thought about ego. When someone says ego, you got to get them to define their terms because they always mean something else other than what you think. You ever notice? So this is very simplistic, not philosophical at all. But to me, ego is simply when, you know, when you... We have this term, being self-conscious. You know, when you feel self-conscious, you're just like, ooh, you know, you feel like everything's, buddy's looking at you, or like the universe is peering into your, and it's kind of uncomfortable. Self-consciousness, it's a way that consciousness is always sort of turning back and looking at itself, right? So consciousness turns back. That's what self-consciousness is. Consciousness sort of turned back, and what it looks at is ego. That's ego to me. How am I doing? Am I good? Am I bad? Did I like my parents? Did I not like my parents? Did I have a fortunate, you know, am I worthy? Do I have a shot at enlightenment? You know, oh, I knew I was actually worthless all the time. The endless stories about one's life, right? The endless stories, the voice in the head that's translating every experience, right? Translating means it's turning it into something it's not. Does that make sense? Like you go outside and you go and it's say raining, and the truth is it's raining. Nobody wants that, though, do they? Nobody wants that. It's raining. What they want is, most people walk out, damn it, it's raining. I hate the rain. Rain sucks. Why is there so much rain? Right? That's translator. And then the translator thinks that its story is true. Or someone goes out on a sunny day and says, sunny days, God, sunny days are wonderful. No, they're not. They're sunny days. To see, you feel wonderful right now in the sunny day? Great. There's a wonderful feeling now that I'm in this. I mean, I'm not saying that people should edit the way they talk, but you see, the translator is not only negative, it's also positive. One of the mistakes people make is they want to get rid of all the negative self-talk and keep all the positive. But the positive is just as much a crock as the negative. Right? To even go outside and say the sun is shining, that's not even true, really. All that's really happening is a nice warm sensation on your face and your shoulders and whatever else you got exposed. This bright, shiny thing up there that's consuming itself just for you. Destroying itself. But anyway, basically when consciousness refers back in that way that we talk about being self-conscious, and all that stuff that it refers back to generally is 99% of it is probably is ego. My story about this moment and all other moments. And about anything and everything that I meet in this moment or have ever met in any other moment, ego. Self is the act of self-consciousness. Self is what we call, in spirituality, we will call it turning within. That's self. Self isn't a thing, it's an act. It's called turning within. Of course, you have to turn within to have any sense of your ego, so that's... So self is just turning within. That's what it is. It is what it does, and it does what it is. Turns within. So for all the ways that this is described, all the sort of, you know, spiritually extravagant ways that no self is described, what I think it is in a much more real way is the loss of your inner life. Just imagine tomorrow you wake up. Everything's the same as it ever was. Your hair still, you know, has the strange twist in it it does every morning that you try to get out of it, unless you cut it all off. Everything's the same that it ever was, except you just don't have an inner life anymore. You don't have a bad one. You don't have a good one. It's just not there. And you might find it kind of strange, so you'd try to find it. And no matter how hard you tried to find it, you couldn't find it. So So if you were a real egoically centered person, you'd look in for your ego and you go, I can't find the darn thing. That would be really strange. If you were spiritually, you'd say, gosh, I focus my whole life, let's say, on the inner stillness or presence of being, that warm sort of glowy kind of feel, and all of a sudden you couldn't turn in and find it. That your inner life disappeared. That's no self. Now, somebody with a psychological orientation would probably think, my God, that's a pathological, what would you say, deviant at best. Do you know? Now, a pathological person is completely self-obsessed. It's totally different. But if you look at it, those of you who've had some of this ebbing away of what this energy, if you really look at it, what you'll see is actually what's ebbing away is your inner life. That's what ebbs away. What's your judgment about this? It's not there anymore. Don't you feel that that person shouldn't have done that to that person? Can't find it, sorry. Well, where do you think the world should be going? Couldn't come up with it if I had a gun to my head. Aside, on what basis would anybody actually know? I imagine that's why in Zen, a lot of times, the best sages were often thought of as lazy fools. Not because they didn't do anything and they were stupid, but actually had nothing to do with being lazy, sitting around, you know, doing... It didn't have anything to do with being lazy. It was trying to depict that experience of that sort of turning of consciousness within, stopping. Or as Buddha said, nirvana, cessation. It ceased. What ceases? People think, oh, suffering ceased. No, that's what your ego wants. Suffering to cease. No, you ceased. Yeah, but what does that mean? It means your inner life ceased. Again, not a good sales point for enlightenment. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things that you know, you only understand until once it's already happened. And because if if somebody had told me this before I had any experience of it, it's like the only thing that I can make out of it would be some sort of pathological condition. Do you know, like, that doesn't sound good. So I just like sit there like a toaster with no like inner life, you know? Isn't that what like rocks do, you know? So, you see what I mean? So I would understand that kind of some version of that kind of interpretation could happen, but it's not that. It's not that you fall into some state of stupidity or you regress into some state where you're so underdeveloped. Do you know that you're like a 2-month-old infant or something? It's not what it is at all. the best experiences you have don't really have to do with one's inner life anyway. In fact, everything you do, everything people do for pleasure, mostly everything, is to escape their inner life. It's called escaping themselves, right? Escape yourself. I'm going on vacation, right? And I hope I won't take myself with me. I'll go into a situation that will be so easy and I'll be taken care of and I won't have the things to complain about that I usually do because I'll either be somewhere I like the mountains, or I'll be in Hawaii, or I'll be in a desert, or whatever, you know, whatever you like. And when you're in a place that you really like, when you're happy, when you have a you have a sense of well-being, whatever gets you there, maybe you've gone to the cinema, watching a movie, you've forgotten about yourself. It means you have that moment, you don't have any inner life. It doesn't mean you don't feel anything. It doesn't mean you've become a rock. It means your self-oriented inner life is put on hold, right? So you go to the concert, you know, you go to the whatever, classical concert, or you go to the concert that's rock and roll concert that's so loud that you can't possibly hear yourself think. So you literally can't get access to much of the inner life. You read poetry. You do whatever you do. You come here. Maybe I'll get a little break from, you know, that sort of self-obsession. Do you know? Whatever that is. The inner self-obsession. And if you think about it, the things one does for pleasure, you read a book. While you're reading a book, who aren't you thinking about? You, your neighbors, the people you hate, even the people you love. You're reading a book. You're free from all that. You love it. And what happens when you do your thing that you do for pleasure and you remember yourself? It's not as pleasurable, is it? It's not that pleasurable. You're like, oh my God, this movie's gone on for only 10 minutes. It seems like hours. I mean, I know this is funny, but it has a significance, I think, do you know? Because what you realize, when you go to a movie, what you're really judging it by is how little you reference yourself. Also by, you know, where you think it's intelligent script and, you know. But if you're sitting there in the movie theater remembering you're in a movie theater all the time, you come out of that movie no matter how great the reviews were, and someone asked you, what'd you think of it? I thought it was crap. How could a movie that can't help you forget that you're in a theater be any good, at least to you, right? Why wasn't it good? And for the most part, you're not going to tell the truth. Right? You're going to say, well, the character and this and this and this. But really the reason is because you remembered yourself. Yes, the character development was so poorly written that it didn't allow you to believe in it, to forget about yourself. So, of course, in that sense, it had on maybe objective, it wasn't so well done. Do you know? So there is this element that, if I describe it one way, to be to authentically, really, not just a moment of insight, but to really be without self, in the way that I'm using the word self. Sounds very, you know, it doesn't sound very enticing. It doesn't sound very rich. It doesn't sound like a rich, full life that would be loving and compassionate and whatever. But if you then go directly to your life and look at everything you do for pleasure, most of it is to forget about yourself. And then you start to get a deeper understanding that when forgetting about myself, it's not that I become a rock or a log or an uncaring person or a person that's dropped out of society or anything. Actually, I become more alive, more present. And that experience is more full and more rich and more mysterious, more bountiful. So quite contrary to how it might sound, even when you look at people's relative experience, anybody you know, starting with yourself, most of what we do for pleasure are various ways of forgetting ourselves. Right down to drug addiction. Why do you like getting loaded? You're thinking about yourself. Alcoholism. Any addiction, basically. Any addiction that works for you well. I would suggest those are very destructive ways to go about getting a break from yourself. But so, the positive things we do to relieve ourselves from ourselves, and also the negative ways, the self-destructive ways that we go about trying to do that. But however you look at it, to be relieved of that thing you call yourself is a very, is always experienced as pleasurable. So it's quite different than what it might sound like. See, self is fine with pleasurable, selfless moments. But self is terrified of that moment becoming permanent. Because if self wants anything, it wants to be able to refer back to itself and always talk to itself about what a good time it's having. Wasn't that great? Wasn't that a lovely party? God, that was really fun, you know, whatever it was. You know. What if you walked out of the party and in your system, or wherever, you know, whatever you were, even being here, wherever you were, as soon as you walked out the door, the whole thing disappeared out of your system, like flushing it down the John. So the self didn't really even get to go, wow, that was really great, wasn't it? You know? Somebody said, how was it? You go, I don't actually, I'm not so sure anymore. I'm not saying you wouldn't have a memory to, you know, say you enjoyed it or something, but you literally wouldn't, the more absorbed you are in the moment, the less you retain about that moment when you reflect on it later. You ever notice? You might go, it was a great moment. But the more totally absorbed you are, the less you bring with you when you come out of that. The less you bring with you. And of course, spiritual people, one of our hang-ups are, is we want those pleasurable moments like anybody else does, but we want to permanently hang on to it. Teacher, I had this wonderful moment last week. I was so open and blissful and flowing, and you know, it was just great, and I wasn't obsessed with myself anymore, and life was just flowing. And how do I get that back? It's a great question. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? I feel feeling good. I'd like to feel good again. But the truth is simple. There's no getting anything back. Anything you ever can get back is a counterfeit. It's what was, not what is. It's one of, for some people, it's a really hard lesson that they have to learn, they go through. When they have really moments of spiritual clarity that are always have a beauty to them, a simplicity, a flow, a selfless quality. The flow is the selfless quality. And then it might, the trajectory may close down a little bit, and then they may want it back. They may learn some of the tricks of the trade to get it back. I think of them as like chiropractic adjustments in consciousness. You know, they're all over the place now. You can read them on the internet. You can open books, ask this question in this way, and it might just like, oh, yeah. Yes, nah, I'm awareness again. I get it. Yeah, I'm pure awareness. Whew, I forgot that for a moment. Glad I had that little pointer, do you know? And I always tell you, as long as it works for you, fine, utilize it. Use it. The day will come where it won't work at all, but utilize it while you can, do you know? And then the day will come, either maybe immediately or down the road, when all of a sudden nothing will work anymore. Nothing works. Nothing. How do I get... I feel so confused. How do I get back to that state of pure awareness or pure being? And nothing works anymore. And you anxiously show up to an event like this and go, God, I hope that guy will tell me something useful. Why is he prattling on about this dreaded no self, no inner... You know... You're supposed to be asking me, you know, who I am all the time. Something, I don't know. Or, you know, I don't know. You could be, maybe this is useful information or whatever. See, but there'll be that sort of desperate, how do I get that back? And then you won't be able to get it back. And you'll think when you can't get something back, you'll think that somehow you made some terrible, drastic mistake. You've sort of regressed spiritually, and you might find become kind of despondent about it. The only thing worse than never knowing heaven is knowing it and then feeling like you're not in it anymore, because now you have a comparison. Before, you just had, you know, wherever you were, you had your projection of what it would be like. But then at some point, in some way, and for many people, it comes very hard. Not everybody, doesn't have to be hard, but it often comes through kind of a hard way where they realize there's no getting anything back. Even if I could get it back, what would be the point? Just to lose it again and want it back again? What would be the point? What am I doing here? Do I just got another addiction? That I get nervous and anxious and snippy when I'm not in my extended I am awareness place? Do you know? Anybody ever felt that happening? Okay. And however you come upon it, however it comes about for you, at some point, that way of turning back toward yesterday will stop. Maybe just because you're too exhausted. Maybe because you understand it's just not. If it's not here now, then it can't be reality. If it's only back then it can't be real. If it's real, it has to be now. It has to be here. Right? Reality can't somehow become not reality. It can't hide somewhere. It has to be now. In fact, it is now. And not just a piece of it. Every single piece of it is it. Even the losing of it is it. There the infinite is, having the experience of losing itself. If you get that, then the experience of the infinite losing itself is the same as the experience of the infinite finding itself. But that's usually a hard one for a lot of folks. That when we even think of oneness, we often think of it as some sort of particular experience that's indicative of realizing oneness, right? It feels this way. Oneness feels like this, which is completely at odds with oneness. How could oneness be this and not all of that? Yeah, but I like the oneness that's this. It's shiny and it's bright and it's never confused and it's never, do you know what I mean? It's never tired and, you know, I want that. That's the oneness I want. Yeah, but how could that be oneness? The jokes we pull on ourselves, I mean, I know these because I pull them on myself. That's how I know them. And I see that mostly we all pull the same jokes on ourselves. I mean, by and large, you know, there's really not much unique in the whole thing. You know, we have our own unique way that we pull our own chain, but, you know. But boy, ego and self, it actually doesn't want to realize that it is one. That there's only the infinite, and this is it, right now. Anywhere now may be. It wants that now to look and feel a particular way. That's what ego wants. I want my enlightenment to be happy all the time. I want it on my terms. Why can't I have it on my terms? Because it's just one. That's the thing that's hard won for a lot of people, including people who've had real legitimate awakenings. Often that awakening, you know, when you see something for the first time, it's like, wow. Remember your Christmas presents when you were kids and you got that toy, you know? Wow. It's the best thing in the world. 2 months later, you still had the same toy. Were you going like, wow? You may have fun playing with it, but you're not going, wow. You're not being surprised by it every second. My God, I still have the toy. It's like Christmas all over again. You're not like that. You might appreciate it. Well, it's nice. It's still here. Okay. Covered a bit of ground, huh? I hope you don't take all this too seriously. One of my favorite, like, whimsical poems, I don't know, I remember just the last few lines of it. And it was talking about different spiritual approaches and different spiritual vehicles. And it closed with these lines: in the end, all vehicles towed away at owner's expense. I love that. I found more reality in those two, that one sentence, you know, than, you know, sometimes books and books of teachings. So let's see, we got about 15 minutes left. Let's see what's on your mind. Come on up, my friend.
Hi, Ajay.
Nice to see you again.
So I'm Craig. I was really amazed at how you described that of what's going on with me with a lot of this falling away. Mm-hmm. And I met an old friend a couple months ago, and he kept asking me if I had a brain injury.
The reasonable question, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've just had so much loss of memory in the last couple of years, and it seems to be somewhat speeding up. And I noticed for for a long time I had a lot of that terror that had set in with it.
Yeah.
And then at some point, that terror seemed to drop away. Mm-hmm. And in its place was this just a huge trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's been really, really beautiful and really, really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not what you expect to be on the other side of fear. Is it?
No, not at all. And it's the beautiful thing was that it just came. Like I didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And the shocking thing with a lot of this falling away, because I remember I asked you a while ago, I kept asking you, like, what is no self? And you basically told me to get out of here and go find on your own.
It's the only way you can do it.
And it wasn't that I had done anything. It was like I'd wake up in the morning and there was not anything there.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it feels like, I had this experience a couple months ago of I was expecting a big check to come to me in the mail and it didn't come. And I realized what happened. I had to go and argue with somebody, and it's like I began to argue, but I had this bizarre experience of seeing that person is actually me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that the pieces of my mind that normally can create an argument, uphold an argument, maintain logical arguments, it was just like crumbling. It was like a tool in my hand just crumbled.
Just falling apart. Yeah.
Yeah, and I keep having that, and it's bizarre. And like in relationship, my partner will be like, don't you love me? Don't you think about me? And I don't really think about anything.
Yeah, she asked the question. Yeah. There is so many things about, what I think of as real awakening, because I think real awakening, it may start with a, moment of aha, but, and we're kind of taught, unfortunately, I wasn't, but I think a lot of people are taught, like, that's it. And what I found is what you're finding also in your own unique way. Is what my teacher had said. She said, awakenings, you just got your foot in the door of reality. You think you know everything that's in there, but you don't. You think you know the ramifications, but you don't. You think you know all of it, but you don't. But that's okay. You'll find out. But the moment of aha is just the foot in the door. And then you start to realize. And sometimes that the process of that unfolding, because a lot of it is, for most people, there's a process element that's quite apart from just the insight part. This is like the non-sexy part, is it, right?
Yeah.
It's not sexy. It's not sort of just a bunch of really powerful insights. This is the site that doesn't make for a good sales pitch. It doesn't make for, really compelling stories, But this is, to me, like the things that you're talking about here. We've talked about some of the other things with you in the past as well. This is the real part of it. This is the unfolding of it. And it often has its strange elements. They're strange just because we haven't really seen it and lived it, It seems strange when you may start an argument and all of a sudden you see that the one you're arguing with is really yourself, and in the middle of that, your argument starts to fall apart. That's a little strange. It's weird to have a totally different experience of what love is, because love isn't You know, years ago, she's adjusted to it now, but Mukti, my wife, when she started to see all this, it like really concerned her. When she'd say, you know, Ajahn, when you go away and you teach, and I was going away more often then, now she seems to go away more than I do to teach. But, and she'd say, when I realize when you're not, I'm not thinking of you, you're not there. She says, I don't feel love for you. I don't feel anything for you. I don't even know. You could be completely obliterated off the planet for all I know. She said, you are really completely and absolutely gone. And it can be disconcerting to somebody, you know, like, they can be just gone.
Oh, I think it's great.
That's, you know that, right?
Yeah.
You've experienced, because you know that that's not an indication of a lack of anything except attachment, right? That's all it is. Grasping is no longer there. It's not a lack of love or a lack of anything, you know, but you know. But for the people around you, yeah, for your beloved, it's kind of like it can be really hard for them to be like, now how does that work? Like, I don't exist when you're, you know. I'm not even suggesting y'all tell people necessarily, you know, but this is just my way of like saying there's a lot that unfolds that is... That's different than what we expect, for sure.
Yeah, and so there's all this dropping away, mm-hmm. and at the same time, it seems like at first when it came, it was, and I hate to make it sound this way, but it was like, I'm awake, the world's asleep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one with everything. And then it dropped into, it feels like I'm awake, everything's awake, I am everything. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a no self, but like everything is me.
Yes.
And it's not
yes.
outside of me.
Yeah.
And that's
the paradox,
different.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
There's no self, but everything is myself. Yeah.
Yeah, and then also in it, I see that, you know, I'm a dad, so sometimes the dad role will come forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a therapist. Sometimes the therapist role will come forward. When I teach, sometimes that role will come forward. But also it seems that there's that there is something here and something quite incredible here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a long time under the teachings of no self, I deeply denied that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and that...
easy to do.
Yeah, it was like I kept trying to get rid of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the silly thing is that as it began to fall away more and more, then I began to see me everywhere, mm-hmm. as everything. And I guess in there was some subtle fear that would, maybe a bigger fear that would come off as being more ego.
Oh, right. Yeah. It only becomes egoic if we try to own it. But it can also become egoic to try to disown it, too.
Yeah.
Right? Because then you're denying of truth. There's the denial of truth, and then there's the sort of proprietary ownership of truth. And if there's not denying, and there's not that proprietary ownership in the sense of specialness, you know? Specialness independent of, but if everybody's and everything's special, then, well and good.
Yeah, what I found in it is this, it's funny to almost like want to be totally anonymous and at the same time just fully in love with myself, if I can say that.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah.
Walt Whitman wrote a 100-page poem to it.
Right? Yeah, and that's the thing, like when I read Walt or hear Walt, it's like I cry so deeply because there's such a, it's like there's such a love for himself, all of self, all of life.
Yeah.
All at once. And then it's in everybody and everything and just, yeah. Just like radiating out of everything.
Yeah. 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 That's exactly why I love him too.
Yeah.
And because he does that rare thing, at least in spirituality, is he embraces so much humanity.
Yeah.
He's not afraid of humanness. He's not really afraid of anything, at least when he's writing. It's beautiful. That's the beautiful thing about it.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was doing, was kind of tiptoeing around humanity because I was afraid to wake up another, crazy dragon out of myself or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there is, still a lot of that, just what the hell am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
With all this beauty, all this wonder, all this love. And no drive to do.
I know, it's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bizarre. You know,
it is.
And with, having children, I know, okay, I have to show up this much. You know, I have to be this much of a dad.
Which is actually really good.
Yeah.
It's really good for you because it keeps you connected.
Yeah, it keeps me grounded.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they don't let me get too far.
Yeah.
You know,
no spiritual fairy tales for you, Dad.
Yeah.
It's true.
Well, it's... In a sense, it's like the fairy tale has come just in the most ordinary, mundane, incredible life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably the biggest secret, is just the mundane, ordinary life has the greatest beauty to it.
Yeah.
Has the greatest beauty to it.
Yeah. Unimaginable beauty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Arthur.
You're welcome. Glad to hear from you.
Yeah, good again. To see you.
It's nice to hear that trust really showed up. Yeah. Yeah. You put your hand to your lips. Come on up. Yeah. Thanks.
Hi, Aja.
Hi.
My name's Drew Ann.
What is it?
Drew Ann.
Drew Ann. Yeah. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
face
you.
Face to face.
I've seen you at SLMR and a couple times here in Boulder, Denver. What this gentleman just brought up, the awakening, the dragon within, just really clicked. This falling away of the drive, I'm experiencing some of that. And some of it I'm having conflict with physically.
Mm-hmm.
But... I'm closing on a house on Monday, and I've been kind of like, it's been flowing beautifully, the whole negotiation, everything. And there wasn't really a drive of, I have to have this house.
Nice.
So that was really interesting to, experience until yesterday. Mm-hmm. then the dragon arose with this... you know, negotiation of the inspection. But so there's this, you know, third chakra, existential. It's not really so much a fist as it is a shield.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really like your help with this inquiry with it and what I've been experiencing with this.
What is the shield shielding?
I'll have to ask. The opening. You know, there's some layer of emotion, but my physiology says yes to that.
Yeah. Go with your physiology. And if there's emotion that kind of wants to express itself or purify itself out, that's fine too.
Yeah, and there's a whole story. I mean, I can feel the story building.
You could do that.
Yeah.
Well, not necessary, but you could.
Yeah, so just yesterday and today, sitting here with these inquiries in and waiting to see if the physiology opens mm-hmm. to that layer, you know, it occurred to me that's a significator of truth, the opening response. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not really the truth. It's the judgment about meeting the judgment of the holding. So
yeah, that's the layering on of conflict, right?
Yeah.
And there's the conflict, or and then the judgment of it, and then the judgment of the judgment, and it can get very complex.
Yeah, so it does. It has been feeling like dropping through.
Yeah.
But I think the essence is the opening.
Mm-hmm.
The.
Well, just see. So you feel, you experience like there's a holding, and then when I asked you, you know, what is it protecting, and it's just protecting. Being open.
Yeah. So when I sit with that, is that the truth? Just protecting the opening, it starts to open.
Mm-hmm.
And then it quickly closes back down. yeah. So.
Can you see how the closing down, it's kind of like... if the space in this room could make a fist right in the middle of itself, right? Just be like a transparent grasping. It's not. That's all it is. Something just...
Yeah, I can feel the openness around this, yes. Mm-hmm. And I can feel the movement of it.
Mm-hmm.
So like a undulating kind of.
See.
And it does kind of start to drop through the rest of the shock. It starts to drop down. Yeah.
See, it's becoming conscious, just becoming conscious of it. That's all. We're very conditioned into... I have to do something with everything.
Yeah.
Right? Everything that's we don't go, I feel open. What do I do about that, Aja? How do I manage? What process do I need to go through with this openness? It's only the opposite, right?
Yeah.
And then our mind says, okay, that's indicative of something that I need to do with it.
Yeah, a problem. Yeah.
A problem.
Yeah.
Right, a problem.
Yeah.
And as long as you see it as a problem, then it's going to behave like a problem.
Well, and just saying it's a problem, it starts to open.
See, because again, you're just naming it. It sees itself as a problem. See, it's truth that liberates. It's not what you do with the truth.
So the truth liberating a belief by meeting the belief?
Yeah. Like, I don't want to open. or whatever it is, let's say. I don't want to open, I'm afraid. Okay, yeah. I don't want to open, I'm afraid. You can't meet it and be trying to get rid of it at the same time. You notice?
Yeah.
As soon as you meet it, and you're not meeting it to get rid of it, you're just meeting it. Oh, what is it? What is that protection? It's protection. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And you just, oh. And in just that, there's a response. It often responds. It often opens. But as long as you're trying to open it, it's like, no way, man. Go ahead. Go through your process forever. I don't care.
Yeah. And it's, right?
Make this so wrong that, and so necessary to open, it doesn't matter. I'm going to just stay closed. But it's like you go outside. It's a sunny day, okay? You look in your bean. There's a closeness, okay? What is it close to? This. Close to being open. Ah.
So using the... because there is an agenda here.
I know, that's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
The realization was, okay, now you can trust your body. If it opens, then you've hit the truth.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, that was the real, yeah. That was the,
I mean,
analysis.
The body's better than your mind.
Right, yeah.
But the body has all sorts of responses that have nothing to do with truth. You ever looked at somebody that you've had some bad thing happen with and your body goes, ugh. I mean, if you were to go, oh, there's ultimate truth right there. Great. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yes, there is a way that the body can be used in a wise way. I'm not denying that, you know, to open. But even that, if you're not careful, that becomes like the new agenda.
Well, and I can feel the openness in spite of the body.
Yeah.
Or whatever, through the body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at is the tendency of the mind to pathologize everything it doesn't like.
Yeah.
This is wrong, therefore it needs to be solved.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying there's never a time to inquire more deeply or look at more deeply, but I'm looking at some totally underneath all that. The way our mind makes things that are uncomfortable wrong.
Yeah.
Let me ask you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just use your word. Does openness see that this barricading, what, to whatever level, does it see it as wrong?
No, there's just an acceptance. I mean, really a profound acceptance of it.
There you go.
Yeah. Wow, that just shot right. Okay.
That's the result. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you just see it from the truth rather than thinking I need to do something with this to get there.
Yeah, so then the expanse, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I just said. Does the expanse have a problem? Because I didn't believe that you couldn't go right to the expanse. I know you can go right to the expanse because I know that's what you are. So of course you can go right to it.
Oh, this is very good. Cut right through. Yes, yes.
Yeah, 50 barricades, big deal. You still are what you are. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like somebody putting a toll booth between here and the moon. Do you know?
Okay.
You don't need to stop at the toll booth.
Yeah.
There's a lot of space.
Yeah, I can see the fixation.
See what I mean?
In the,
you got to go through here and pay the toll in order to enter space. But there you are. Hey, it's on both sides of the toll booth.
Yeah. Oh, very good.
Which again, could be used as a denial of whatever you're experiencing, or it could be seen of as soon as you really realize that, then the toll booth or the fixation tends to open up. Like you said, then you could feel it energetically. It just opens up.
Yeah.
You see it from the truth.
Yeah.
Rather than see it as a problem that you need to work through in order to get to the truth. Go right there and then let the truth have its... I'll just use the word relationship with what's there. See how it's in relationship with what's there.
That's all fine.
Yeah.
It's better than fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Okay. I could pathologize that I always go late, but I think I'll not.